Joseph Smith certainly translated the Book of Mormon by divine power. Absolutely, no questions about that. I don't think it's entirely out of the question that this could presume that God could help Joseph Smith translate this text as a translation, and that we don't need everything spelled out. God speaks to people according to our understanding and according to our language, but the Book of Mormon remains a translation of an ancient text.
Hi, and welcome to Conversations with Interpreter. I'm one of your hosts, Thora Shannon.
And I'm your other host, Avram Shannon. And today we're very lucky to have Spencer Krauss with us on the on our show today. So I'm going to read a little bit of his bio, and then we're talking about a very fun paper today about some of the Book of Mormon translation things. Welcome to the show, Spencer.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good, good. So Spencer Krauss is a researcher for the Ancient America Foundation. He graduated from Brigham University with a bachelor's degree in computer science, modern Hebrew, and ancient Near Eastern studies. He has published on multiple areas relating to the Book of Mormon, the Bible, and the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through venues including the Interpreter Foundation, FAIR, Scripture Central, and BYU Religious Studies Center. He worked as a researcher for Scripture Central from 2019 to 2025, where he contributed to over 160 Know Why and Evidence articles. So today we're talking about your article published to the Interpreter in 2025 entitled A Closer Look at Transliterations in Divine Translations.
Can you actually tell us just a brief summary, like what your paper generally is about for everyone at home?
Yeah, so my paper looks at the transliterations that appear in the Book of Mormon. The transliteration is when if you're translating a text and you come across a word, instead of translating the word, you just copy it, you know, almost verbatim, into the language you're translating in. So words like Kirlam, Kumam, Liahona, Ramiamptum, these are all words that appeared on the gold plate text of the Book of Mormon that for various reasons didn't actually get translated into a word like Bountiful, you know, the place name there. And so I look at all of these and I essentially point out that the consistency and the types of words that are transliterated rather than translated match what you'd expect a translator to actually do, and especially based off of other historic translations, including translations of the Bible.
That's interesting. And can you, I know in your paper you talk about reasons why, because we see transliterated words, obviously not just in the Book of Mormon, but in lots of ancient texts, and even, frankly, modern texts. Can you talk about maybe some of the reasons why we would see those words? Why do translators not translate a word, but instead choose to transliterate a word?
Yeah, I mean, scholars such as Emmanuel Tove have pointed out quite a few reasons, one of which is the low frequency at which words appear in the text. There are some words that only appear once or twice in a text like Kirlam and Kumam that because they just don't appear all that often, more than likely than not, people just don't translate them because you don't have enough context to know what they are. There are other things like technical terms especially don't always have a one-to-one correlation between different cultures and languages. So this is especially common with like weights and measures. In the Hebrew Bible, we have words like a epha or a hin that in the King James Version and even more modern translations don't always try and say like, oh, well, this would have been about so many pounds or ounces, you know, and it's just easier to transliterate those as like so many ephas.
The other day, my daughter was, we're going to come follow me. And she's like, Daddy, how much is a hin? And I was feeling waggish that, and I said, 1/10 of an apha. And she's like, thanks, Dad. I'm like, sorry. That's about all we know in some ways.
Yeah. Like, and that's the thing. Sometimes you just don't know enough about, you know, these technical terms to be able to accurately say anything about them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and not just technical terms. I feel like there's just words, and you talk about some of this in your paper, that just don't have one-to-one meaning. Like, for a modern example, the word hygge, in Danish or koshli in Norwegian, you know, like it's like kind of that cozy, but it's like cozy when you were doing something that was uncomfortable before, like you're drinking hot cocoa by a fire, but it's snowing. Like it has all these meanings that you can describe and you can describe in paragraphs, but you're not going to get in one word. And so they just don't translate it, right? Mm-hmm. And we definitely see that in scriptures as well, where I think you point out in the New Testament, in one translation, they kept logos as logos rather than trying to find an equivalent word in English that just doesn't exist.
Yeah. You know, David Bentley Hart is one translator who just keeps it as logos because he says the word has so many meanings, it's impossible to accurately pin it down to just one. So you can't just say the word. He just has to say the logos, because to try and translate this is to leave it a conceptual phantom of itself, he says. And, you know, this is the case with other texts as well. I'm aware of, I quote from, or allude to, this happens with other texts as well. I cite one translation of a Lotus Sutra, which is a Hindi text, and they just transliterate the word Dharma because, again, it has such wide meaning that it's impossible to really pack it down into a basic English word for people.
Even I think President Nelson introducing chesed from the Bible to the church, where, and again, he gives a translation for it, he gets a meaning for it, but of course part of why it's come in as chesed so much is because...
Or chesed, lots of people say too, in English.
Chesed is fine, but chesed is because it really, again, as you know, it doesn't really have this one way. It's proper behavior, it's relational and covenant relationship feelingness, you know?
Yeah, but it's just a lot that it's hard to unpack, you know?
Yeah.
So you gave a specific example to us just right now for the low frequency words, like something like Kurlam, but can you tell us a few of the words maybe that are in the Book of Mormon that are transliterated that would be under this like category, would you think?
I think the most famous example is you have in the Book of Alma a whole list of weights and measures, and most of these only appear in Alma, and it's just one quick, well, let's lay everything out, and then occasionally you'll hear about a C9 again, but you usually don't do that. You usually just forget they're there. And so these are words like C9, Seyon, Shum, Limna, Sanum, Amnor, Ezram, Antai, Shiblon, Shiblum, Leah, and Antion. We don't know exactly how much these weighed, what they were, except what the Book of Mormon tells us, in that, you know, one was a tenth of a hin, we could say.
No, admittedly, I could not list off that list without looking. Not like I've memorized. I don't know if anyone's memorized it, just because it appears, you know, one time.
Yeah, like I had to look because
it's a lot of words we don't know.
Yeah, it's a new scriptural mastery challenge for the seminary students. How about that?
Perfect. And then you give a third reason as well, and you talk about the rare plant or animal names. Can you talk about a little bit why those might be transliterated?
Yeah, rare plant or animal names are typically left untranslated in a lot of translations, because oftentimes we just don't know what that animal or plant is. In the Syriac Peshitta, it's a translation into Syriac of the Bible for early Christians. They often left some of the bird names in Leviticus 11 untranslated, because for Jews who are using this translation as well, you don't know what these birds are. It had such a long time had passed that you just couldn't be able to ascertain what they are. And you don't especially want to accidentally break the law of Moses if you're, you know, following the law of Moses. So they just left it untranslated.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that if you accidentally put the wrong bird and suddenly they're going to be like, we can't eat this anymore because it's not a clean bird. It's unclean. It's against kosher. Right? Like that's a really heavy weight to bear as a translator. I can see why they chose not to do that.
But hoopoe is so fun to say.
It is. That, for all we know, that could have been the real reason. It's like, hey, these are fun words, you know?
Actually, I was just reading in Exodus, the stones on the high priest's breastplate. And of course, it's another thing where, as you're going through translation, you're like, we don't know what these stones are.
Yeah. Like, some translations will make their best guess, but it's a thing where it's like, you know, if you want to maintain as accurate a translation as possible, sometimes translators just don't translate. And there's another case in the Mishnah, Mishnah Bikurim.
Can you tell us really quick what the Mishnah is?
Yeah, so this was the oral traditions, the oral law of Moses. And it was eventually written down around, I think starting of the 2nd century.
Yeah, about 200 AD. CE, AD, yeah. AD 200 is about when Judah put it down, yeah.
Yeah, and so you have, you know, this additional law of Moses, if you will. And in one of these, it talks about this animal that no one really translates. It's called the koi, and this passage reads, there are ways in which the koi is like a wild animal. There are ways in which it is like a domesticated animal. There are ways in which it is like both a domesticated animal and a wild animal, and there are ways in which it is like neither a domesticated animal nor a wild animal. So with such a clear description of what a koi is, you know, people are wondering, is this some type of goat? Is this a cow? Is this some sort of hybrid animal like a mule? We just don't know. And so in order to maintain the, you know, are their understanding of what this is, they just don't translate it. Because,
and quite frankly, the nature of Mishnah is such that, honestly, it's not an impossibility that the compilers of Mishnah at that point already didn't know what it was, right?
You know?
And so it's not just – and so the other thing that's intriguing, especially as we'll talk a little further on in our discussion today in the Book of Mormon, is sometimes it's not just the translators don't know what a word means, but even the transmitters no longer know what a word means.
Yeah.
So, for example, in the Book of Mormon, Mormon himself may not have known anymore what, like, it's something meant. Or Moroni, when we're talking about the Jaredites, right? Like, obviously, you talk about several examples from the Book of Ether, where we're talking with a civilization was long before the Nephites, and so you get all sorts of words, like Deseret is, I know, one word you talk about that, like, yeah, Moroni himself may not have known the word. It may have just been transliterated it.
Yeah, and I mean, Kirlam and Kumam is, I think, probably the best indication we have that a Nephite prophet, like Mosiah or Moroni, when they came across this word, they don't know what this is, you know? Like, so they could have just written it down, and then eventually the plates get to Joseph Smith, and as he's translating, you just have the Nephite transliteration of Kirlam and Kumam on there that Joseph Smith just translates as such, you know?
So good.
So, you know, I think you bring up a really good point here, which is that Joseph Smith is the one who just kind of takes the transliteration. And I think a question that becomes, or begs the question is, if Joseph Smith is inspired of God, then why can he not just know the perfect word for it?
Or why does God give him to it in that way, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, there's just so much we don't know about the Book of Mormon translation. There's so much I don't think we'll ever know about the Book of Mormon translation, other than it was done by the gift and power of God.
I often tell my students, I'm like, what do we know? And they'll pair it right back to me, gift and power of God. And I find it very compelling that the person who knows the most, i.e. Joseph, tells us the least, right? You know, all he ever says really is, I did it by the gift and power of God.
Yeah. And I think this is just one example of, you know, Joseph Smith certainly translated the Book of Mormon by divine power. Absolutely, no questions about that. But the Book of Mormon remains a translation of an ancient text. And so, you know, God speaks to people, you know, according to our understanding and according to our language. I don't think it's entirely out of the question that this could presume that God could help Joseph Smith translate this text as a translation, you know, and that we don't need everything spelled out. Like, if Joseph Smith were to translate the Book of Mormon, and in the list of weights and measures, he were to say 32 pounds of wheat is, you know,
could be
traded for this, that would be more suspect for a lot of people than if he were to just say a shiblon or a seum, you know.
I think you have a good point there. And, you know, it's helpful to remember that I feel like God did inspire Joseph Smith, but Joseph Smith is still a translator. He's not, God didn't need Joseph Smith. I guess it could be like Moses in the mountain where his hand could come out and write like the
finger
commands.
Written by the finger of God.
Yeah. But he doesn't work that way, right? It's very much through the voice of Joseph Smith as translator. And we do see that signs of translation. And I think it's actually a good thing that we have it there. I feel like that the layers that we get from that are much more interesting than if God just came down and told us I would be thinking it's really cool if God came down and told us everything about the Nephites, but also it wouldn't be as much like an authentic ancient text anymore. It would just be God telling us things.
Yeah. And, you know, they're especially compelling because in virtually every single case, you have compelling arguments for old world or even in one case, a new world etymology for some of these items that would have been unavailable or unknown to Joseph Smith, you know? And so to see these actual, you know, Hebrew words appear in the Book of Mormon in the same context that we'd expect from a translator to leave them in, I think it's a great testament to Joseph Smith's role as a translator of an ancient scriptural record.
So can you share with us a couple of your favorite examples of that, of kind of like the sort of the etymology? I know there's the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, but you give a couple in your paper that I think are really interesting to kind of talk through a little bit.
Yeah. So one example is Ramiamptum. This is a word that appears in the Book of Mormon that, even has a gloss by Mormon as he's compiling the text. It means holy stand, which is another indication that this is a word that's perhaps unfamiliar to Mormon. It's a Zoramite word for their place of worship that he places in here and gives a gloss for his Nephite and Lamanite eventually and modern audience. And this actually does, Matt Bowen and others have argued that there are aspects of, you know, Ram or great in mm-hmm. there.
Ram being a Hebrew Rome root.
Yes.
Actually, so Avram's name, you know, great father, right?
Yeah, you know, and this is also another fun case where Emmanuel Tov identified common nouns that are sometimes mistaken as proper nouns are often left untranslated. I think this is actually another good example of that because this word only appears in the one instance where Zoramite religious practice is necessary to understand the context of the Nephite history that Mormon is recording. Because, you know, Mormon is contrasting the Zoramite false worship with Alma's worship. And in order to do that, you have to understand just where the Zoramites are wrong. The Zoramites would spread out throughout the Lamanite-controlled lands. I don't think it's out of the question that they would build other holy stands and continue their model of worship. We know that the Amalekites, when they went into the Lamanite lands, were allowed to build their own synagogues in Alma 21, I believe it is. And so it's probable that there are multiple Ramiamptums in the Americas. It's just not important for the Book of Mormon narrative because it only is critical at one point. And we often think of it as a proper noun, but it was probably just a common word for the Zoramites, you know? That's just like churches for us.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, in both Hebrew and in Egyptian, you didn't have capital letters yet. They hadn't been invented yet. And so even if, like, whether it's proper or not, you don't have that handy, like, capital letter to tell you this is a proper noun that you see in English. So anytime, like, Ramiamptum is capitalized with Mormon or Liahona is capitalized, all of that is a choice, of course, of Joseph Smith and whoever scribe was writing it to decide this is a proper noun because it's not going to be marked in the text regardless.
Yeah.
That way.
Liahona is actually another great one. There are multiple proposals for that. One is like, look to the Lord. I think Matt Bowen proposed that one in another interpreter article.
Yes.
And that, again, we it's a particular item, but we don't have enough context to know if there are multiple items that could have been called a liahona. It very well could have just been a proper noun, in which case it would have been best untranslated anyways. Gazelum is another one in Alma 37. In this one, we don't know if it's the name of a prophet. You know, I'll prepare to my servant Gazelum a stone. Is Gazelum about referring to the prophet or the stone? If it's referring to the prophet, well, proper names like Nephi or Lehi or Alma aren't really translated anyways. If it's referring to the stone, well, this is another technical term that would probably be best left untranslated because, you know, what could this stone have been like? Think of like the Urim and Thummim in the Hebrew Bible that we come across all the time. The teraphim is another one that some translators just don't translate.
Cherubim, like cherubim.
You know, this these things aren't atypical of what you'd expect a translation to look like.
Can you talk briefly about, I thought it was really interesting, kind of going back to what we talked about before, you talked about Joseph Smith and how he turned one translation in the Old Testament into a transliteration, and I thought it was a really interesting story there.
Yeah, this is actually the thing that I found that set me on this path.
Oh.
Is in the Joseph Smith translation, so between 1830 and 1833, Joseph Smith starts his inspired translation of the Bible.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a lot of things. Sometimes it's restoration of ancient texts or oral traditions that weren't written down. I think Moses, you know, 1 through 7 would especially be qualified for that.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have Joseph Smith's inspired commentary in the text, and sometimes you have him trying to make the Bible more readable for a 19th century audience. And, you know, Robert Matthews and Kent Jackson have talked a lot about that. I think one of the cases of the latter is in Isaiah 34:7. The King James Version reads, "And the unicorns shall come down with them, the bullocks with the bulls." And the word unicorn, when modern readers think about this, we often have this image of the Celtic mythological, you know, horse with one horn. It's pure. It's this mystical, magical creature.
I have many daughters who adore their unicorns, you know?
You know,
that's what I was thinking.
It was such that Marco Polo, even when on his journeys, when he came across a rhinoceros, wasn't sure what to make of this thing because he's like, this is a one-horned creature, but it is nothing like the unicorns that I know. And he even says, you know, it's a very ugly beast to see and unclean, and they are not as we here say and describe, who say it lets itself be caught in the lap of a virgin girl. But I tell you, it is quite the contrary of that which we believe it was, you know. And so here you see him. He's not sure what to make of this. The original Hebrew word is re'em, which would probably refer to some sort of oxen, you know.
It's a very different image also than the Celtic unicorn.
Yeah, it's not, I hate to break this to people, but unicorns and dragons in the Bible do not mean that there were actual mythical horses and fire-breathing dragons, you know.
You're ruining all my illusions, Spencer.
Oh, I apologize. I hope that you can forgive me.
I will forgive you, okay. but I may have to go and cry myself to sleep tonight.
All the magic sleep.
And in Joseph's translation of the Bible, he swaps the word unicorn out for re'em. He uses re-em, which is the transliteration of this word. And he never comes back to it, and he never revisits it. But it seems to me that Joseph Smith, as he's working his way through the inspired version of the Bible, he sees this word unicorns and he realizes this just doesn't quite fit. And so probably with Sidney Rigdon's assistance, he asks, you know, what was this? And Sidney Rigdon was probably the most qualified to be able to point him to, oh, this is what the Hebrew word is. And he's like, okay, well, it's probably not a unicorn like we think of, so we'll just write this in here and move on. And for Joseph Smith, that seemed to be sufficient in this instance.
Yeah, and I think that's a great insight into how he did the Joseph Smith translation and the New Translation, and also possibly how he approached the Book of Mormon translation.
Yeah.
Obviously before he ever met Sidney Rigdon, but kind of realizing that even though, as we've already talked about, he was inspired of God, that he also is a human who comes across a word, and if he doesn't know what it means, like Kerlum or something, that he goes with the transliteration that he can come up best with for the, you know, the sounds, because he doesn't know, possibly. It could be one reason he's doing it.
Yeah.
And one thing I thought was really intriguing about your research, just thinking about this in terms of other divine, because you said divine translations, right? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, this is, most of your evidence is from the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Which is great. The Book of Mormon gives us in some ways our best whatever for it. You've got this great thing from the JST, from the New Translation. But of course, you have all these words in the Book of Abraham that are also transliterated.
Yes, like Kokhobim is the big one, which is the stars. That's directly from Hebrew, you know.
Yeah, but one thing I think was interesting about that is in the Book of Abraham, they're almost all glossed.
Yeah.
Right? Kokhobim, that weird Rakiyang, which of course is just Hebrew Rakia, right?
And what does Rakia mean?
Rakia means the dome of the sky. It's KJV's firmament, which is, again, what it says in explanation, like literally, you read explanation back to Exodus 1, like, oh, this is not a weird word at all. This is just Hebrew here. But I think that tells interesting things both about, I think potentially, about what's underlying the Book of Abraham text, as well as what Joseph is doing with it. So I think this is, again, a really fruitful place for thinking.
Yeah. No, it absolutely is. I think the same methods and methodologies that went into the Book of Mormon or the Joseph Smith translation absolutely would have applied to the Book of Abraham as well. You know, especially Joseph's learning Hebrew at this time, it would have been especially helpful for him as he's translating the Book of Abraham, that he's like, oh, I can, you know, better put these into a transliterated form.
Yeah, although part of with that, by the way, of course, with transliteration, one of the considerations in transliteration is how do you write sounds that the language or your target script doesn't have. So, for example, in the Book of Abraham, there's this weird gnolam one, right? You know, and of course, whatever. But when you realize, and you can do this by going back to some other things in the Book of Abraham and some of Joseph's stuff, or that he's learning Hebrew, that gna sound, there's supposed to be the ayin. Of course, ayin is not a sound we have in English.
Yeah.
Olam, Hebrew. Then you realize, oh, this is something. So learning actually just mistransliteration makes those easier as well.
And, yeah.
Which I think is, full circle again, would be really intriguing to think about what sounds, for example, do the Jaredites have maybe that the Nephites don't, and vice versa. And what are we losing from our transliterations from how it actually been pronounced, I think is a fascinating question.
Yeah, for sure.
Just thinking about that.
So are you working on any more projects in this vein, or is there any other academic work you're want to share with us that you're moving forward with?
You know, right now I'm presenting next week as of the time of recording.
So this is that big conference on the 29th and 30th of May on the Small Plates. Tell us about your paper, Spencer.
So I wrote this paper with Neil Rapley. We're looking at a pre-exilic context for the passages in Isaiah that are quoted in the Book of Mormon, and showing that a lot of the, you know, evidence that people have used to date some of these passages later could also be used to date it earlier, to a point where it could have been on the plates of brass that Nephi and his family took out of Jerusalem.
So for our reader, this specifically the passages from, say, Isaiah 40 to 53 that are quoted in the Book of Mormon that many biblical scholars put in a Babylonian and even a exilic and post-exilic context.
Mm-hmm.
And so your suggestion then is that that's not a necessary argument to make.
Yeah, and even another argument has been that Isaiah 2 through 12 would not have existed in its present form on the brass plates, but a lot of scholars have actually argued that this is a core literary block, and I think that Isaiah 2 through 12 would have been a prime, you know, candidate for the brass plates text.
That's a really fun paper.
Yeah, no, it's been really fun to work on and write. Another thing that I'm working on is I'm a co-author on the BYU New Testament commentary for the Epistles of John that I'm working on with Lincoln Blumel.
How exciting. So.
Excellent. There have been some really good volumes in that series.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you can't come to the conference, I think this will air after the conference goes, but they will have recordings of the proceedings, as well as there will be a book published with all the proceedings. So you'll be able to catch up with those at home, for everyone at home, if you want to read or hear what you're doing. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Well,
thank you. It's been my pleasure.
So good to have you, Spencer.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Conversations with Interpreter. To read the articles and scholarship discussed today, visit interpreterfoundation.org. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with others who seek learning by study and by faith.